News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. Signs of consciousness have been seen in racing legend Michael Schumacher 3 months after a skiing accident. The ex-Formula One driver has been in an induced coma since suffering a serious head injury. Elle Bircher, a journalist for the TV company RTL, is outside the hospital in Grenoble.
Sabine Kim, his manager, said Michael is making progress. He shows moments of consciousness and awakeness. So really good news, because we don't have to forget that he's in the hospital since the 29th of December.
People with severe alcohol-related liver disease in the UK are, for the first time, to be considered for a transplant. It's part of a new pilot scheme, and there will be strict rules about who will be eligible. Coronation Street star Barbara Knox has been charged with drink driving and will appear in court later this month. The actress, who plays Rita Tanner in the soap, was arrested following an incident in Cheshire in March. David Cameron's travelled by train to Dawlish in Devon to mark the reopening of the coastal railway line badly damaged in the winter storms. It's cost Network Rail £35 million to repair. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
BCFM.
Yes, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Henley's Glenys Morgan. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, is Osborne's austerity like a badger cull trial that's failed, best confined to the dustbin? Well, our guest Andrew Fisher might agree with that, because he's a former parliamentary researcher who's just written a book called The Failed Experiment. And as more evidence emerges that the families of those lost on Malaysian flight MH370 believe their government are lying to them, we hear from one who says her government's deliberately misleading families. And Martin Summers wonders, have we been here before? And brings us his Hereford Triangle, disappearing and strange crashes of aircraft over the last few years. And as NATO defence ministers get together at NATO headquarters in Brussels, we hear what their commander-in-chief, the amazingly named General Philip Breedlove, and Obama has to say about Ukraine. And we round off our interview from 2 weeks ago with what the BBC are not reporting on, that is, Occupy London is still going strong as an economics think tank this week. They have solutions, just so Osborne and the Treasury can't say that nobody told them, with Occupy London's Clive Menzies. And part three of Paul Mason's series that he thinks could not be made on British television today. It's about the First World War, the People's First World War. Part three, The Revolutions. That's all in the second hour, after 6 o'clock. On to the news review in a minute then, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry, highs of 13 Celsius this weekend. Sunny spells and some light showers tomorrow, heavy showers and windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, wet and windy at the beginning of the week, fairly sunny though for the rest of the week. And next weekend, 12th and 13th of April, highs of 13 and fairly sunny. Much better next weekend then, isn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Henley's Glenys Morgan. Hi, Glenys. Pronouncing it correctly the second time. And welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, why the Lib Dem party when you got into politics? What was it that attracted you about the Lib Dems rather than one of the other parties?
I felt they were both at the extreme ends that I wasn't comfortable with. Originally member of the SDP, and that became, due course, the Liberal Democrats. But, I mean, I think our current sort of manifesto slogan, responsible economy, fair society, sort of encapsulates it very well. I didn't agree with the power the unions had over the Labour Party in the old days, much as I do want unions to be there, looking after workers' rights and the safety of employees. Equally, I did feel the Conservative Party felt they had a right to govern and exploited people.
But we don't have a fair society, do we? Society is dividing, and the Liberal Democrats have got a big part to play in all that. And so, I mean, surely the party slogan doesn't really mean anything.
We are not an overall power. You know that. Yes, the fair society. The gap has widened, which is really worrying. And I think it widened under the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. Yet we're in the coalition. I think we're doing things that try and improve it. I do like the idea of the pupil premium, for example. Helping those children right at the beginning, because we know that's where inequalities start, and they just get worse and worse from then on. So that's one good example of where I think we are trying, and within the coalition we've brought, you know, that's come in.
And the economy's looking worse and worse. The other trouble, isn't it? I mean, no, I'm just wondering, with your Lib Dem slogan, both sides of it seem to be not working.
Well, put us in power, and I think we can help improve it.
I mean, the economy's a real difficult one. We've got, your sort of superstar in the spotlight there is Vince Cable, and he's had an absolute drubbing this week over a diabolical sell-off of the Royal Mail shares, where the public, it looks as we've been robbed by £14 billion. So he's not really giving a great example as to what should be done with the economy when it looks as if he's just doing a few nice jobs for his old mates at Shell and in the city, and actually losing £14 billion, which should be being spent by the taxpayer, paid by the taxpayer, should be being spent on services by the government.
Right. Well, if you'd listen, Vince Cable was on Question Time last night. Quite interesting to hear. I mean, what he said in that report, maybe we could have done better. Maybe we could. But it is the responsibility of the government to be cautious. It is public's money. I think there was the threat of a strike. He said the report that came out recently did mention that word cautious. You can't judge people on just one week either. I mean, if you look back at the way Vince Cable had warned about how the sort of economic chaos we've had with such a long recession, how he warned about that in advance. I mean, I think his credentials overall are very good. He's taking advice, and from what I heard also, that a lot of the people who were investing it, the companies, are actually pension funds, if I've got that right. So, you know, that is money that will be coming back to ordinary people who've holding pensions. So, yeah, maybe it could have been a bit better. I think I think that's possibly exaggerated. It's very difficult to get right if anyone who's tried to invest in shares has seen. And don't forget, a lot of the workers are going to benefit from that as well.
Yeah, well, I was talking to a postie the other day who said, well, it was a bribe, wasn't it? What do you think of that?
A bribe?
Well, bribing the posties to go along with it by actually just putting money in their pockets, saying that this is all good.
Well,
isn't
is that a no-win situation? I mean, if you hadn't given them the chance to take a share in it, I guess you'd be lambasted for that as well. So.
This came up, before we hear from Martin Summers on this, it came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Here's the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, and Prime Minister David Cameron on this very subject.
No wonder they're looking for a change, because there has got a leader who hasn't got a clue.
Mr. Speaker, he's gone as red as a postbox, and that's because he knows that he's lost £1.4 billion for the taxpayer. This is a sale nobody wanted and nobody voted for. A national asset sold at a knockdown price to make a fortune for the few. It's a symbol of a government who stands up for the wrong people, with the British people paying the price.
Just then, Mr. Speaker, it's a sale nobody wanted. It was in his manifesto. It was a commitment of the last government. They're shaking. They worked so hard, Mr. Mr. Speaker. They failed to do it, but this coalition government privatised the Royal Mail, created thousands of new shareholders, have a great business working for Britain.
Sorry that cut out there. But actually it was proved afterwards, Martin, that it wasn't in the Labour manifesto, apparently, that Mr Cameron got that one wrong. But anyway, £14 billion is a lot of money. You could do quite a lot with that. You could build goodness knows how many hospitals, schools. You could employ vast numbers of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even of people. Why £14 billion too little did the taxpayer get for Royal Mail?
Are you asking me? Well, I think it should never have been privatised at all. I think the political point being made by the Prime Minister that the Labour Party in the past talked about privatising the Royal Mail. Peter Mandelson pushed for it quite strongly when he was in government. And I think this just shows the disconnect between the political class in general and the ordinary population. Most people in Britain, for example, want the railways back in public ownership. All opinion polls show that. But the mainstream political class has got two audiences that it has to speak to. One is the electorate, and the other is the paymasters, the City of London, Wall Street, and the people who really decide things in this country. And ultimately, the Prime Minister is able to score points off Ed Miliband there because the Labour Party, in the past, bought into this privatisation dogma themselves. And that's the real problem. If we've got all the major parties buying into the privatisation dogma, then there isn't any real alternative on offer. And that's a real danger.
But we're talking about everyone, the whole country, something like £2,000-£3,000 per person, but everyone has been shortchanged.
Well, yes, and there's other similar things going on.
I mean,
like
particularly
that,
for people at the bottom end of the income, that is a massive amount of money.
Yes,
that can make the difference between being able to make ends meet and not.
What the fact of the matter is that the coalition government is not opposed to subsidies. It's opposed to subsidies for poor people. Effectively, those who've got £750 to invest, and a lot of the so-called institutional investors stagged the shares immediately and made a quick profit. And of course the Help to Buy scheme is actually lavishing money on those already on the property ladder, and this is all taxpayer subsidy. The pensions decision to give allow people to take their pension pots and spend them now, they were allowed to have tax relief on those pension pots because they were pension pots. In other words, the taxpayer has again been shortchanged, and I smell an election coming, and I smell that swing constituencies with prosperous voters who are already on the property ladder, who are doing quite well, nicely, thank you very much, nice subsidies for them, but for the poor, a kick in the teeth. And the real problem is that the poor don't vote. More's the pity.
Glenys, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, I agree with what a lot of Martin was saying about the city's profiting from all of this. I mean, nothing's ever... Well, partly why I'm a Lib Dem is things are not only black and white, you know, they're grey most of the time. And, you know, Gordon Brown sold off gold for too low a price. Mm-hmm. That didn't do well. Certainly, I think a lot of things that were privatised shouldn't have been, and then equally some things that were public weren't run well. So again, you know, ideally you're looking for a balance that will get things better. You were talking about the right to buy being for... just for rich, for people.
Well,
it's
not just for first-time buyers, though, is it?
Yeah.
Second-time buyers can also access the funds.
Yeah, but mainly for... And, I mean, that is also a huge worry, I do agree. I think it has helped first-time buyers, but we need more housing, and it's a very good chance that this will run away and create huge inflation again, as Vince Cable actually has been warning, I believe, today. Mm. I was just trying to remember some of the other points you made, Tony, that I was interested in. I'll have to come in when you're speaking, and then I'll be able to.
Okay, okay. You do feel free to interrupt Martin. He's quite good at interrupting others. Anyway, also today in the Independent, Vince Cable has announced he's refusing Labour's demands to reveal the details of the cosy Royal Mail sell-off deal. Business Secretary Vince Cable's refused demands by the Shadow Business Secretary Chuka Amuna to release the names of the 16 city investors who reneged on a deal to remain long-term shareholders in the Royal Mail. Mr. Amuna made his demands in a letter to Mr. Cable, citing the Independent's reports of a gentleman's agreement made with a select group of 16 city investment companies that they would be long-term shareholders in Royal Mail in return for being granted priority status and a massive extra allocation of shares. In the event, within weeks of the float, these investors had dumped more than half of their stock, a profit estimated just within a few weeks of around £300 million. Would you like to explain that. Why isn't Vince telling us who these people
actually,
are?
Well, I'm puzzled by that, because I thought on Question Time last night he actually did name some company like Legal & General, and a lot of them were, as I say, pension companies. So I need more.
He was saying pension funds, mentioning pension funds
generally.
Well,
I did say Legal & General, I know, so whether that's slightly out of date information.
Well, no, this is... oh, hang on, yes, possibly. Yeah. Wednesday, yeah. That was. Martin, this isn't very good, is it? Where a little... as anyone, as an ordinary investor, is only allowed to get so many shares, and yet deals are done behind the scenes where the big investment firms can get massive amounts of shares. They have to keep them for a certain amount of time. It's all there written into the contract by the government, but then they just ignore that and dump them.
Well, they weren't written into contracts. It was just an understanding that they would hang on to them.
Ah, you're right. Sorry.
Gentlemen's
agreement. Well, they're not gentlemen, are they?
Well, exactly. This is the problem. This is that Vince Cable has made a big
mistake
there, presumably.
Would you make a gentleman's agreement with a shark?
Well, Vince is a sadder and wiser man this morning, isn't he?
Well, possibly.
Predictably so. I mean, this is what happens in these situations.
OK, on to another story. And the BBC this week have been running a week-long advertorial for Hargreaves Lansdown. An advertorial is where it's really an advert for a private business, but it's dressed up as some kind of news report, which is supposed to be unbiased. Well, we've had the Tom MacPhail from Hargreaves Lansdown on Points West Every Day this week, I believe, talking about pensions and analysing pensions, but of course from a point of view of Hargreaves Lansdown, who sell and deal in pensions. I thought this was a little bit strange to see BBC doing advertorials. I thought they were supposed to be a public service broadcaster paid for by the public. And so I contacted the BBC's head of centre, the former news editor, Louis Mesquito, by email and on his answer phone, but he has not responded to my request to come on. So next week I will carry on trying to get someone on here to explain why the BBC thinks it's a good idea to spend our licence fee payers' money on doing advertorials with Hargreaves Lansdown. I will be asking the news editor on next week. Strange, isn't it, with Points West? Because at the end of it, you would expect to see some credits, who the news editor are, the producer, etc. You get nothing. Maybe the presenter's name, but you don't see the names of the people who have actually put the programme Points West together. Martin, the thing about Hargreaves Lansdown is that we know that Peter Hargreaves, for example, was interviewed several times under caution by Scotland Yard detectives for possible fraud charges when he was working. Because we had a chat with a detective about that, didn't we?
Yes, that's Rowan Bosworth Davis, whose blog is very interesting. He's not just critical of Hargreaves Lansdown, to be fair. He submitted a report to the Andy Tyrie's Banking Committee, which essentially, because he's now a professor of criminology, proved that virtually all activities of the city are in fact criminal according to international definitions.
Now, he worked for 12 years as a detective at Scotland Yard and the fraud squad, and he was interviewing Peter Hargreaves about doing something which is a bit naughty, which is taking clients' money, saying that it's going to be invested in doing a deal with them to invest it in certain shares, and then using his insider knowledge to invest it in other shares. I mean, why is that fraud?
Because it's presumably the things that are being invested in are more risky than the punters realise. And as long as pays off, that means that the punter gets their money back and whatever they're expected to get, and there's an extra profit for the dealer. But of course, if it goes wrong, the punter's money goes down the drain and they lose everything.
I mean, you could also consider possibly that it's insider dealing. You know, if he's had inside information about whether a company's going to be doing
inside,
well or
not. Insider dealing is normal practice, I'm afraid.
Isn't this just further examples of how all these kind of take just abuse the little man, if you like, you know, they, and it's been shown. I mean, how many bank scandals have there been now with the protection insurance, endowments,
payment protection insurance,
LIBOR, foreign exchange fraud.
Interest rate swap, fraud, yeah. Money laundering by HSBC.
Thank goodness we've got journalists and people who are prepared to look into this and speak out, because it's so well covered up and often, I guess, within the law, but only supposedly
it isn't,
later,
it isn't within that. This is what Bahaghali, this is what Rowan Bosworth Davies argues. Yeah. A lot of this is outside the law,
yeah,
but it's so pervasive that if you start arresting somebody, you'll have to arrest everybody, and you can't do that, so we can't do anything.
Yeah.
And that's where we've got to.
All I say is, I do hope Rowan has kept the notes from those interviews and that Mr. Hargreaves is listening to this show.
And
one other thing that bothers me is, you know, it does seem that it indicates that you've got this little cosy elite of people who are rather too friendly with each other at the top of the BBC and the top of some of the big financial institutions who, let's face it, if they hadn't been bailed out by the taxpayer in 2008, would be right now be on the dole. Anyway, Badger Coal has been rolled out, has been shelved as the government backs down this week over the future of pilot schemes. Plans to extend the Badger Coal to new areas have been shelved, but controversial pilots will continue despite a series of failures in trials last year. The Badger Coal will not be extended nationally this year after an independent report found failures in the effectiveness and humaneness of trials last year. Glenys, what are your thoughts about this Badger Coal? Because it is, a lot of people have strong feelings about badgers not really being deserving of this treatment. And also, I mean, having spoken to many farmers, they say that the tests that are done to test for TB on the cattle actually catch lots and lots of something like over three quarters of the cattle actually don't have TB, but they come up positive on the test. So they're killing a lot more cattle too than they really need to. So anyway, what are your thoughts on badger culling?
Well, I think it's such a complicated subject, and the detail that people have gone into to justify their side and the other side. I mean, I do, you know, I've some farming background, small farmers, TB is terrible, and you know, it's not just badgers suffering, you know, cows suffering, other cattle. I do think the government possibly felt it had to do something to help the farmers, but I don't believe this was the answer. And I guess without being a scientific expert in any way, hopefully vaccination will come, but I gather that, you know, wasn't down the road enough to be you know, suitable for applying now. So
when I was at school, I remember having a little sugar cube for TB. Can't they give those to badgers, Martin?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I haven't got a scientific background either. So we're to some extent in the hands of the experts here, one way or another. It's not really a political issue in that sense. Although I would point out that a lot of the farming industry in this country, just like in many other European countries, is in fact a subsidised structure. And if we did have a free international free market, we probably wouldn't, for example, be farming the Somerset levels at all. I mean, the British farming industry was in a bad position from 1888 on. Onwards, when the Dunedin docked in London with lamb from New Zealand cheaper than it could be produced in Britain, and the writing was on the wall for farming. If you were going to pursue it as a free market farming, farming is a subsidised industry.
If we look even further than that now, with climate change, people are recommending we shouldn't be, we don't want animals, we should be keep to our vegetables and fruit because of the methane that's being produced is a really big problem. So.
Well, there are all sorts of good reasons for that, aren't there? Because, you know, you get a lot more calories from actually producing cereal foods than you do through producing meat. So maybe that's the way humanity's going. Who knows? Anyway, back to Westminster now and down to the bricks and mortar. Jeremy Corbyn asking a question of the Prime Minister David Cameron about the cost of housing, something which hits us all.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. Is the Prime Minister aware that at the present time in Britain, in England rather, 3,956,000 people are in the private rented sector. The organisation Generation Rent finds that two-thirds of them feel insecure, half of them think they pay far too much in rent. Does he not think it's time to end the social cleansing of inner-city Britain by bringing in proper rent regulation with a fair rent formula and total regulation of the private rented sector to give people security and peace of mind at where they live?
Where I'm sure he and I would agree is there's a need to build more houses, including houses in the private rental sector. And I'd say there's cross-party agreement for that. Where I think he's wrong is full-on rent control has been tried in the past, has actually tended to destroy the private rented sector, drive everyone back to the state sector, and reduce the quality of housing as a result.
Gosh, sorry, cut that off again there. But Glenys, what are your thoughts about the idea of rent controls Jeremy Corbyn's floating there?
Yes, I don't like the idea of too much control. You know, we've been over-controlled in the past, I think. But there is a lot of work to be done on Well, for example, within the council, we look more into licensing. I think there's a long way to go where landlords can sign up, pay a small fee, and that's been done in areas down Stapleton Roadway, I think, where so that there is some control, local control. But
you mean licensing for landlords?
Yes, so that their premises are run properly. You know, so many people.
But
you know,
most landlords will think, well, why should I bother with that?
Well,
because they've got plenty of customers at the door, haven't they?
That's the trouble. That's why. But good landlords will be happy to go along with it because it does mean they can show that they are, you know, they've got hygienic, good, reasonable conditions, and hopefully be more popular. I mean, we may not always be in the position where there's a big demand for rent. You know, it goes backwards and forwards. But certainly, there's the conditions can be quite dire, and also properties, you go up a street and the outside looks such a mess, and really affects people, the whole environment for people who walk past. So yeah, there's. I don't like overall control, but I would like to see more voluntary codes that people can sign up to, and people can ask. You know,
what was your experience, Martin? Because you were looking recently for some accommodation Easton, weren't you?
I actually live on Stapleton Road, and part of what was going on the council came round, and they sent around, you know, various people to look at the property, you know, people to look at the electrics, people to look at the various aspects.
I guess they're seeing if they're getting value for money for the benefit.
Well, I mean, that's right. But then what happened, of course, they insisted my landlords, who are in fact the Bank of Ireland receivers, because I nearly got evicted during the crash because my landlord went bust. And so the Bank of Ireland receivers are my landlord. They then, of course, decided that rather than do all of the things that were required, the easiest thing for them to do was kick me out, which is what they did. So I then had to find somewhere else, which was actually quite difficult, because what's happening, and if you think for young people in particular, it's really difficult to get anywhere to live. Very real struggle.
Well, that's coming back to the thing that will regulate is having enough housing, and there's amounts to be done.
In the 1950s, the Conservative government of Macmillan built council housing, mm-hmm. and it was actually
we've never recovered from that.
Well, but we sold off the housing stock as part of the right to buy, which mm-hmm. Labour did nothing about in the 13 years it was in power. And of course, councils are forbidden from building new houses by central government, even if they wanted to. And then, of course, we've now got a generational crisis of people who are just they're not going to be able to buy houses. Mm-hmm. They can't rent houses in the social housing sector because there isn't enough. And the private rented sector then becomes a monopoly, as it were, and they can charge pretty much what they like because there's no rent control. Rent controls in themselves are very much a stopgap measure. Yeah. What Ed Balls is promising is that we're going to bite the bullet and build lots of houses, which will stimulate the economy and so on. I mean, that's right, but it's very late in the day, isn't it, for a generation which probably, you know, even if we started building tomorrow, you know, that we've got to write off our 20-somethings today are not going to see much from that, are they?
Okay.
And I don't like seeing our children looking at housing as a way to fund their retirement. I think that's
absurd, isn't it?
But that's what they're doing, you know.
Well, in Germany and places like that, the house prices haven't risen in 40 years.
No.
Nobody imagines that they're making money on their houses.
Back to Westminster now, and it's the anniversary of the introduction of this wonderful thing they call the poll tax.
25 years ago yesterday, a hated poll tax was imposed on the people of Scotland. It ended with the Prime Minister being kicked out by her own party. Will the Prime Minister take this opportunity to apologise for that tax?
I've made clear my view about this issue many, many times over many, many years. I think the council tax is a much better replacement. The key now is to keep the levels of the council tax down. That is why on this side of the House we support a freeze.
A freeze, sorry. Keep cutting out the ends of these things. But actually, in a way, the poll tax did happen because we got something called council tax. The whole point being, Glenys, that it's levied on the individuals in the house, not on the owner of the property. Now, quite often, the individuals in the house are poor. The person who owns the property, obviously, if they own a house, they're going to be richer. So what is the point when it comes to paying council tax? That this is levied on people who probably can't afford it, rather than being levied on the people who own the property who can afford it?
Well, I I'd agree with you, yeah. It's that isn't a fair system. The valuation, of course, is so out of date. That needs to be looked at as well. Yeah, what are alternatives? Are we being
well? Just the rates.
The
rates was where it used to be before 1989. It was the rates, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, in Northern Ireland, they still have the rating system.
Yes,
because the politics of it was they brought in the poll tax in Scotland because they wanted to test it on them, and of course it enraged them. But of course, they never thought of bringing it in Northern Ireland, because don't forget that both council tax and poll tax rendered on individuals are priority debts, and they're collected by private debt collectors. Now, if you can imagine people going down the falls in the Shankill Road, mm-hmm. two guys to take away people's tellies, this is a scenario where people, the police and the army turn up armed to the teeth and terrified. It was never going to be a runner. And I think that the rates were actually a system that was there for hundreds of years, because in actual fact, the property-owning classes are the best people to pay those taxes. It shouldn't be forced onto the poorest people.
Yes,
silly.
Those who own the
property,
in a way,
they got their way with the poll tax. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's our wonderful William Waldegrave mm-hmm. from just down south of here. I can't remember the name of that village, but anyway, just in between here and Wells, who was one of the three people, along with Victor Rothschild, who drew up this wonderful idea of not taxing the poll tax, not taxing the people that own the house, but the people that live in it who can't afford to pay it. So let's tax the poor. Just on that subject, though, I was looking at the new postal charges, and would you believe the biggest increase in postal charges is for the second-class stamp, which the poorest people use. Over the last 2 years, that has increased by nearly 50%. The actual price of it is now up to 56%. It's come up from about 35%, pence, up to 50-something pence. So why is it, honestly, it irritates me. It's a regressive tax, Martin,
yes.
is it?
Is that what they call it? That's what you call it.
What you're doing is you're trying to make people that have got no money pay, whereas what you're doing is you're slackening off all the taxes on the rich. Just seems completely wrong. Glenys, though, what's your thought?
I agree, and it's we see it with other things. You know, people who can computers go online, they get reductions. People who can afford to do direct debits. It's the poorest people very often who are suffering again, who get the worst of the deal.
Doesn't sound like a democracy. It sounds like a plutocracy to
and
me.
And the interesting thing with the stamps is, of course, it's for a long time now, the price is curve. Who remembers it? I mean, do we even know? Do you know what the price of a second class stamp is? It's second, first. It says we never know the actual price.
Yeah, because the actual price has moved so much. There's no point in them printing the price on there anymore. It's a bit like these digital things you see on the side of petrol stations. You can almost see them zooming up as you're driving in. Quick, get in there before it goes up anymore. You know. Anyway, a related thing, of course, to do with this almost deliberate attempt, it seems, to get people into debt and poverty, is that bailiff powers. Some good news for a change today have been cut under new UK laws. Restrictions on entering homes and seizing property are praised by campaigners who say industry is rife with abuses. This is in today's Guardian. Bailiffs are to be banned from entering homes at night and from using physical force against debtors under new laws coming into effect this weekend. Further changes will also prevent enforcement agents from entering properties where only children are at home and from taking vital household essentials such as cookers, microwaves, fridges or washing machines. Bailiffs who collect roughly 4 million debts each year will also have to be trained and certified to practice under a shake-up of laws designed to bring an end to aggressive behaviour. Now, Glenys Morgan, you're the Liberal Democrat councillor for Henleys. Could you just say what you think about this? Because this, to me, I find it incredible that anybody could set up as a bailiff up till now, don't have to go through any kind of certification or training to turn up on someone's door, manage to force their way in and take their possessions.
Well, I'm horrified by that. And this can only be a move for the better. I mean, obviously, we don't want people who are who've been deliberately not paying or what they should, and you don't want people to just get away with everything. But so many of these people are going to be in a very, you know, it's often not any fault of their own that they've ended up in that situation, you know, with redundancies, whatever. And to think that, so they're a very low point in their lives. And then to have people come in violently, coming in at when only children are in the house? I mean, what sort of how long are they going to suffer from that sort of experience? And I think people are going to be able to keep their essential items like washing machines and fridges. I mean, this just seems like common sense. And how did they get away with it for so long? Is the take I have on it.
Citizens Advice Chief Executive Gillian Guy said, "We help with 1,000 bailiff problems a week. People have reported bailiffs giving debt letters to their children and threatening violence. These new rules reflect just how out of control the industry has become and a welcome step towards protecting people in debt." There's another thing I would say on a legal point, and that is that you may get fines coming through your door, bailiffs turning up to try and enforce those fines, but if those fines have never been through a court, magistrate's court, they're not worth the paper they're written on. I did a piece of research
when I was working at Bristol Debt Advice Centre a few years ago, looking at, because it was a Liberal Democrat MP, Lynn Goldsworthy, and she'd got stats from all over the country about bailiff visits. And, you know, some, as you might expect, the poorest areas had the most, this is to collect the council tax, the poorest areas had by far the most, so Tower Hamlets by far the most visits. But once you'd factored in deprivation, so I then correlated the figures with deprivation, and eventually we got a list of councils in Britain in order with the most who were most likely to send in the bailiffs and the most who were least likely to send in the bailiffs, and then I had that mapped against political control. And surprise, surprise, mostly the Tory councils were the ones who were most prepared to send the bailiffs. Mm-hmm. Yes. Although Richmond, which was Liberal Democrat controlled, was the worst, unbelievably. But Tower Hamlets, once you'd factored in the fact that it's got a lot of poor people there, they had no more bailiff visits than you. Bristol was right in the middle. Mm-hmm. So the tendency to send bailiffs round in Bristol was exactly the average. Yeah. But ultimately, of course, the rates were so much easier to collect, because if people don't pay, you just impound the property. It's as simple as that, and they just have to pay. They've got no choice. Yeah. Whereas what you're doing is you're chasing lots of people on low incomes who haven't got a lot of money, and just think of the money spent on the bailiffs chasing this £200 debt. It's not actually a very efficient way to collect money at all. It's a silly way to collect money, and it causes all sorts of antagonism and so on. But of course, as I said before, in Northern Ireland, that doesn't happen because it was just too dangerous.
Northern Ireland, yeah. Tony.
It just shows that they didn't dare to test the society to the destruction by pushing poor people as hard as that, and that was very sensible of them.
And one of the things I saw on when this came up on the television earlier today was a lady who was falsely being accused of owing the money. She had bought something, sold it on, so it was nothing to do with her, but yet the paperwork came in, and we can be really caught up in this terrible paperwork system. You know, computer says no. And it's really hard to fight against that. Lots of injustice, I think, can come out of those sorts of being in those sorts
of
situations.
Well, there's a whole bunch of people who believe they are undergoing a similar sort of injustice, but they are the Clifton traders. They're very angry in a protest on Park Street this week against a proposed parking scheme. Traders, fearing for their livelihoods, blocked the city centre in Bristol here on... Yes, Wednesday, that is, a protest against the residence parking scheme in Clifton. It's the old residence parking scheme.
Yes, more
than 300 people marched from Clifton Suspension Bridge to the Council House, otherwise known as City Hall, carrying a homemade coffin to signal the death knell of Clifton Village. The parking scheme goes ahead. The group blocked traffic in Park Street, chanting, shouting and blowing whistles at the Mayor, George Ferguson, who briefly confronted them. He confronted 300 angry Cliftonites, so I think he's a brave man. Heavy rain did nothing to dampen their anger, and they believe the proposed resident parking zone will mean the flow of visitors to the village will dry up, forcing traders out of business. Current proposals are revised plans that were published 2 weeks ago in streets north of Clifton Park. The scheme would run Monday to Friday between 9 and 5. In the streets south, it would run Monday to Saturday 9 to 5. Pay and display parking would be provided near the shops in the village. Now, Glenys, this is people at the moment. Well, you can come and park. You can come and park, I think it's for half an hour, maybe an hour at the most, to do your shopping and leave. The traders are really annoyed because they know that people are going to think, well, if I have to pay to park here, I'll go park in a free supermarket somewhere, and Clifton Village is definitely going to be affected by this.
Yes, I mean, I know that opinion has been very split in Clifton for a long time. I don't know how you solved that. I haven't looked at it closely, but we came upon something similar in our way, and we were talking about blunt instruments earlier, and the resident parking scheme is not, you cannot apply it as a blunt instrument across everywhere. Part of my ward Henley's actually is Westbury Park, and the council have a scheme for Redland. Westbury Park came into that. First of all, we didn't hear about it. The first notice about 3 days before for the informal consultation. But anyway, a lot of toing and froing. Eventually, that scheme got split across the middle because people felt very strongly about it, and were able. Luckily, there was a rough divide where opinion started to be very much for it, obviously near the inner city, and those further out who didn't see the problem, you know, parking fine during the day, it's just the evening that is... Traders very worried again. We did get listened to in the end. Obviously, not everybody's happy, but there will be a chance to come back. But I think when Liberal Democrats started bringing this in, they waited until they had a small majority of those in a particular area who were in favour of it, and it settled in. Clifton, I think, is going to be really difficult. As I don't know the detail, but very opposing views, people who are adamant they want it and others who don't. But the traders, you know, small independent traders, a big threat to their business, I think.
Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do like, for example, what's happened in the centre of Gloucester. If you ever wander around there, you can actually, it's all been pedestrianised, and you can wander around what effectively the medieval city, if you like, and you've even got the Roman street plan, and it's really, you know, as a visitor, I enjoy that. But of course, that's caused all kinds of problems for businesses when they did that. I mean, there was a huge hoo-ha about it. And in Leinster, where my parents live, they want to pedestrianise Corn Square in Leinster. And to my mind, it's an obvious place. But what's blocking it is there is a laundrette, and then people come to use the laundrette, and the laundrette will have to go. And whenever you do something like this, you are changing the environment for local businesses. So it's bound to be controversial.
And it almost comes back to the biggest problem probably Bristol has, transport, and having suitable transport to bring people in. Because I think it is great, and you do see a lot of people strolling around in pedestrian areas, enjoying the shops, and I think eventually it does bring more people in, but you've got to be able to get them in probably some way. And
the whole point of areas like Clifton Village, though, Glenys, is that, you know, people can just stop in the car, pick something up and go. Now they won't be able to do that. They're going to have to be sticking their money in the slots. It's more time consuming, it's more costly. They're going to be thinking to themselves, oh well, I'll go somewhere else, won't they? Can you see where the traders are coming from here?
Oh, I do, but although it's really difficult to try and get a parking slot in Clifton anyway, I think a lot of people are beginning to be put off by that. And it is supposed to be the case that if you're there for, you know, there is a turnover of people going round. But as I said, you've got to bring people with you. So
interesting as well that, of course, it's the Cliftonites that are getting together here and doing a big march and protesting, where you know, maybe poorer areas of the cities won't, the communities don't have the spare time and cash to get themselves organised against it. Also, this is from a few weeks ago, but the Bristol Mayor approved the plan to sell Bristol Docks, and a little sentence in the story in the Bristol Post I didn't notice in between the various eulogies for Chris Skidmore and Charlotte Leslie and George Ferguson. Council sold a 150-year lease to the Bristol Port Company for £36 million in 1991. £36 million, that is. That was a lease. Since then, the company's always wanted to buy the freehold, and George Ferguson has sold the freehold now, hopefully, for £10 million. So that's less than a third of what the old lease was. He's now bought the freehold. Does that sound like a good deal to you, Martin?
Well, I'm still trying to work out what's going on here. I mean, the problem is, of course, that there's not enough money, so there's pressure to realise assets in order to keep existing services going, and that's presumably what George's logic is in this case.
It doesn't make it clear whether they're getting money back for this from this £36 million that was paid for the 150-year lease. It doesn't make that clear. But it doesn't sound like that's a good deal. If it's £36 million for a 150-year lease, the freehold should be higher than a lease. Shouldn't it? I mean, it just sounds to me like maybe the value of the place has gone down or something. But anyway, what about the principle?
The value's gone up,
the principle of selling this sort of thing off, Glenys? What do you think?
Well, what the mayor has said, and I was at the cabinet meeting where he was talking about this, is that he's been told that's a very good price, and he would use it to invest in other project that will bring in further money that can be reinvested again for the whole city. I don't think he doesn't need the money for protecting services, and then certainly that's not the way he's got reserves. That's not his intention to use it that way, as I understand it. But the interesting thing is our party actually has called in this decision and asked to look at it again, because having looked at the paperwork, they believe that what it is saying is that the actual amount of money that will be realised is 6 million, not 10 million. So I think that needs to be certainly investigated and sorted out.
Well, possibly that 4 million difference is some sort of compensation for the not having fulfilled all the years of the lease. Let's not get into too much detail there, but
no,
I mean, it just sounds on the surface of it like a duff deal. Let's go back to Westminster, shall we, and hear another little jot from Prime Minister's questions. This time Martin Hallward's asking about planning in Gloucestershire.
Mr. Martin Hallward.
A planning inspector recently told a closed meeting in Gloucestershire that he would give more weight to consultants' economic models than to, and I quote, 10,000 objections from local people. Is that what the National Planning Framework really meant by empowering local people?
The National Planning Framework is very clear about the importance of listening to local people in terms of development, and actually my honourable friend would have received a letter recently to explain some of the changes in the guidance under the framework to make sure, for instance, that previous housing performance by local councils is taken into account in these very important decisions.
Managed to complete his sentence there, David Cameron. I didn't cut him off, thankfully, for a change. Glynis, now you're on a planning committee.
Just went on one this year, but more important than that is dealing with planning applications locally. I mean, they come in every week. There's some sort of extension plan, but it's we've just recently. Just this week, a planning inspector has managed to agree with an appeal by someone who wanted to build a little bungalow in an area which we thought was terribly cramped, the local people. It was won at committee. The planning inspector was able to turn it over without any... Well, they give reasons, but, you know, I don't think local people are getting enough say in this. And the local people cannot appeal. It's only the applicant who can appeal. And obviously there's a big push to get more housing everywhere. That's fine.
So if planning is approved, the local people can't appeal that decision. But if the planning is refused, the big landowner can appeal.
Yeah.
That's just not fair at all, is it?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot more to do there, and also, engaging with the community in advance. They pay some lip service to it. The council has a very good policy on this, but actually, we're trying to push that's actually what they recommend is done in reality. And we've had one recently for Waitrose, you know, big caring employer, very very good, who. Came along to a meeting, listened to what people have to say, but then they don't come back and explain why they disagree with some of the things that have been erased or explained their reasons for going ahead anyway. So sometimes a lot of lip service is paid to things without actually doing it properly, and it makes a huge... There is local knowledge to listen to. There are characters of areas.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but we've just heard there from Martin Hallward up in Gloucestershire that doesn't matter. 10,000 letters, Martin, are not worth anything when it comes to economic considerations from the people who are putting in the plans.
Well, there's a lot of misunderstanding in the general public of the powers of councils over planning. They don't realise that in actual fact we are a capitalist economy, and basically, unless it's illegal, they can generally do it, and unless you can come up with some very good reasons.
You know what? How I'd sum it up: if we can tax it, you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, but sitting on the committee, of course, you see the other, and you know that you've got to think citywide as well at times, and countrywide. You know, and just because 10,000. It's very easy to get petitions up nowadays as well, of course, online. So there is a balance that's always to be struck. But, you know, localism has got getting a pretty bad name.
Glenys, you mentioned Waitrose there. There's another story this week about Waitrose. You might have noticed supermarket snob David Cameron says Waitrose shoppers are nicer people than customers at other stores. This is James Lyons in the Mirror yesterday. The Prime Minister said he found people who use the posh groceries chain more friendly and thoughtful. Supermarket snob David Cameron has insulted millions of shoppers by saying Waitrose customers are nicer than those at rival stores. Mr Cameron's astonishing remarks came after the Tories were slammed for their patronising beer and bingo budget posters. PM was speaking at workers' John Lewis store in Cheadle near Manchester. Mr Cameron told them, "I've got a piece of supermarket sociology, which is that there is something about Waitrose customers. They are the most talkative. I found if I shop in Waitrose, it takes me about twice as long as everyone wants to stop you and have a chat. Whereas in other supermarkets, I find I can dart round quite quickly and get everything. Something about your customers, they are very talkative, engaged people, particularly thoughtful in comparison to shoppers in other chains. Also, the prices, let's just have a look at those. Just one in 20 shoppers use Waitrose, which is by far the most expensive supermarket. A typical basket of 33 items, known as the Grocer 33, costs £77 in Waitrose, and the same shop was £74 in Sainsbury's, £71 in Tesco's, and £67 at Morrison's, and roughly £67 too at Asda. So very expensive. Also, of course, the land that the distribution depot of Waitrose sits on is owned by Prince Charles, so he takes his little cut of every penny you spend at Waitrose. But Glenys, there's a serious point here. What is it in a supermarket that makes it so snobbish as to say, well, I like to go there even though it's expensive, because you get a better class of customer?
Well, I live round a corner from a Waitrose, and I like it. I do think their staff are very well trained, very helpful. I think possibly David Cameron was engaged, well, maybe more people recognised him there, but my experience of shopping, you know, when we had family, we certainly went to another more supermarket. We went further to get the better price. I think they do have good quality products, but God, it is expensive.
Maybe in Asda, people were just giving him dirty looks and didn't bother talking to him. I don't know. Martin?
I very much doubt whether he does much of his own shopping, to be honest. Well, there's an element of make-believe about all
Absolutely,
of this.
Absolutely, yes.
Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week asking you some questions about the police. We've had another report this week saying the police are wonderful, at the same time as we're hearing all the terrible stuff about Hillsborough. Has anything changed?
Do you trust the police?
I think that there's been so many cover-ups. They've been destroying evidence, manipulating evidence. The Stephen Lawrence thing said they were institutionally racist decades ago. They still are. Nothing's changed.
I've always had a bit of a mistrust of the police, because they're just kind of people like you and me, and we've given them all this power, and why shouldn't they abuse that power once they're in it?
When you want them, they don't turn up. Yeah. And when you don't want them, they turn up.
A bit 50-50.
I've just come from Trinity Road Police Station, actually. They've found my wallet, which was stolen from me. Of course they do, yeah, I trust the police completely. Yeah, they do a wonderful job. It's a very difficult job. Like in most agencies, I'd imagine there may be one or two that don't quite stick to the rules, but I trust them completely. Without them, the country would be in chaos. I've had crimes happen to me before. I've had bicycles stolen from me, and unfortunately they can't find everything, and they don't always catch, you know, the bad guys.
I think they're always trying to do their best. In these moments now, like, there's always like some people trying to make difference for them. I have friends who's had some problems, and the police being quite helpful for them. But I think it's all right.
Are Avon and Somerset Police more trustworthy than other forces?
In fairness, they have been implicated in the kind of investigations here, like Stephen Lawrence or Hillsborough. So there's no direct evidence to say that they've done things just as bad. I think they do deserve more of the benefit of the doubt. But at the same time, those kinds of incidents can't help their reputation.
I think they're just as bad as the rest of them, to be honest. Just tar them all with the same brush.
They're probably the same all over. I'm quite attached to the police, actually, in my job. Well, in times of trouble, they just don't turn up. You could be on the phone to them saying you're being threatened, and you will not get a response out. out of them. But the guy in the cafe threatens the guy behind the counter. The guy says, I've got a gun. So I'm on the phone at the end of the cafe with the police, and it took them probably 5 minutes to turn up. And the police station's 1 minute up the road. But I suppose it goes on everywhere now, because they are pushed for the job they do.
I would be biased because I'm from Bristol, but I think even Somerset Police Force are fantastic. So
I always live in Bristol, so I never live in another areas and other places. I always think they are quite good for what they do. They always like very fast to respond when you call them, and they always like it, trying to protect maximum we can, with always having police everywhere in the city. And I always see police cars everywhere and CCTVs, and they do a good job.
What should be done?
I think, especially with those two investigations, Hillsborough and Stephen Lawrence, I think that people have to get fired and people should go to prison, really, for what's happened, until people face the full extent of the law. And it seems that the police aren't above it, that they are also regulated by the law and by the courts and other institutions. People won't trust them again.
I think they need to be more accountable for their actions. I mean, there is the independent sort of commission that investigates all kind of wrongdoings by police. I think that should be more thorough, and the people who are kind of in charge calling the shots should also be more accountable. The policemen themselves, they're just doing their job, but I mean, it's got to come from at the top, really, hasn't it?
Let's get more police out on the streets, in cars, roaming around, bikes, walking. A community policeman I got in Old Market does a brilliant job, and he's always coming in to see me. We always have a chat. There's not enough of it.
Like everything in life, I think the biggest problem with the police and trust and things like that is putting them on the street so you can get in contact with the police. Unfortunately, that comes down to money and politics. And if, you know, rather than making cuts with the police force, they should be taking more people on. They should be more visible so the public can meet and greet and see that they are just people doing a job, and a fantastic job at that.
To investigate things more to the start, to the end, and not leave it for too long, and then after it's too late for investigate some cases.
Some pretty good comments generally there, a few bad ones. But Glenys, what are your thoughts on local police here and also the national picture?
Yeah, just quickly. Well, local, we've got a terrific local police team, PCSOs and beat manager. They, you know, they have to put up with a lot, and you know, keep their temper, be polite, and that's our area where it's probably better than many. So I've got all the inspectors as well, working with the council for things like Safer Bristol. I think, you know, they do. I'm very supportive of them. I find them great. But we should expect the highest standards.
And what about Hillsborough and Stephen Lawrence?
Those, I think, I am appalled again when I hear what's gone on there. And I think anything like that, we mustn't have cover-ups. We have to go in really hard, as with MPs.
Just coming to the end of the hour, we're going to have to hear from Martin. Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I think the relationship between the Bristol Police and the community is probably the best I've seen in any city that I've lived in. I lived in London for many years. I think that was challenged by the Tesco riot a few years ago, when outside police forces were brought in and behaved very badly. Oh. And the local police are very well aware of the feelings of the community about that. The Welsh Police in particular were completely out of control.
Martin, what about the beast big things, the Jimmy Savile scandal, the sleeping with activists who've never done anything wrong, having children with them, the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, Hillsborough?
Listen, the police are always going to be in the firing line because they're always going to get it wrong, and it's an element of the police
We're hearing things like statements being altered by police to protect them from jail.
The principle is quite clear, and the police officers have to understand it. They are bound by the law, and if they are breaking the law, they will be punished and should be punished. Often they are not, and that's the problem.
National News on the hour. We'll be right back.